Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
Let's go.
Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. And I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we will be talking with Robert Davis and his attorney, Steve Rosenfield, about Davis's odyssey through the criminal justice system in Virginia. Davis was recently pardoned and released after almost 13 years of imprisonment for a murder he did not commit. Welcome, Robert and Steve.
Thank you
for having us.
So, fellas, I've been reading about this story online, and it's quite a story. What I would like initially is, actually, Steve, if you could give us, just to begin with, an overview of the facts of the murder. So I'm sure most people know what this offense was, but some people may not.
Robert was arrested at gunpoint and interrogated for for many hours, starting around 1 in the morning, and ultimately gave a confession after being up for 24 hours at about, give or take, 8 o'clock the next morning. When Denise Lunsford and I were court-appointed because of Robert's indigency, we saw the interrogation tape. We learned that one of the co-defendants was going to be framing Robert and saying that he was a participant. We geared up for trial. We challenged the confession on constitutional terms. And when we lost that, we were prepared to put at trial the issue of whether the confession was reliable or not. We had the only expert. The Commonwealth had no expert. Our expert was Dr. Jeffrey Aaron, who is an employee of the Commonwealth. After weighing the challenges of the case, with a co-defendant saying Robert was a participant and with a confession, we were sufficiently worried that when the Commonwealth gave us a take-it-or-leave-it offer, we struggled hard. We had many meetings with Robert, and we, his lawyers, recommended that he take the 23-year prison offer for crimes he did not commit. Then, about 2 years later, one of the co-defendants wrote me a letter and said that Robert was not involved and that I should visit him at the prison. Denise and I went and visited him. He ultimately gave us an affidavit, the first time that he's ever made a statement under oath. And he said that he framed Robert. Robert was not involved, and he feels very badly about it. It took another many years before his sister, the other killer, would come forward asking me to come visit her and reported to me, which got reduced to an affidavit, saying that she actually was the person who stabbed Nola Charles and explained all the rest of what she had done. And then a petition for a pardon was pending before Governor McDonnell at the time. We waited a year and a half and got a letter saying, on his last day in office, saying that the petition was denied without any reason given. 6 weeks later, I contacted the parole board through Trudy Harris, the investigator, and Karen Brown, the chair of the parole board, said that the McDonnell administration never investigated the case, and she was reopening it. And 18 months later, Governor McAuliffe thought that an injustice was done and granted a pardon to Robert.
So let me back you up just a second, Steve. One of the things that I think we need to sort of lay the groundwork for with people is what the actual offense was.
You know, I heard about this. I remember back in the day hearing about it when it was in the papers. But would you explain to people what, you know, what the crime was that he was implicated in?
On February 19th in 2003, the police and fire department came to a fire on Kling Lane in Crozet, and they found Nola Charles dead and her three-year-old son in another bedroom, both upstairs, also had died. The coroner would say that the child died of asphyxiation from the smoke created by the fire that was started to cover up the crime. Nola Charles had her throat cut and had been stabbed in the back. The charges that went to four kids, all of them teenagers, included first-degree murder for the two murders, burglary, larceny. I think those were the four significant charges.
Was there an arson charge?
Very good, and an arson charge. Those are the five charges. One missing.
You indicated there were four kids. Now, you've talked about two kids who did the killing, mm-hmm. And who both of whom later recanted and said that Robert Davis had nothing to do with it. What about the other kid? What happened there?
What's interesting about him is that he was 17 years old, and when he was implicated falsely by the two killers, by actually one of the killers, when he was interrogated, the detective stopped after 30 minutes because the juvenile said innumerable times, "I wasn't there and I didn't do it," and the detective stopped. Robert said in his interrogation 79 times that he wasn't involved and wasn't there, and yet the interrogation not only increased, but it became more and more oppressive. For instance, this interrogation started at 1 in the morning, and as cooperative as Robert was, at 4 in the morning, without any explanation, he was leg shackled. The room temperature was so cold, you could see on the video, which is on a website, you could see Robert bundled up with his jacket. And all these are tactics that the police use to make people uncomfortable, mm-hmm. and try to break them down psychologically.
Why did they target Robert and not the other kid?
Robert, just like the other kid, was named by the killers. So, understandably, they felt obliged to arrest somebody who had been implicated by a co-defendant.
Of course, but why did they stop with the other kid at 30 minutes and keep going for hours and hours with Robert Davis?
Well, I think the answer is a subjective one, and that is that the police officer who interrogated the other juvenile knew what he was doing, understood the vulnerability of young people, and simply stopped. With Robert, it was almost like a vendetta, where the officer should have stopped, like his colleague. He went on and on, badgering, sitting within inches of Robert in a very stark, dark room, badgering him, threatening him with the death penalty, scaring him to the point where many, many hours later, 24 hours of non-sleep, Robert was exhausted. Do you know that seven times Robert asked if he could just go to sleep? He said, and you can see it on the video, he said, just take me to the jail and let me go to sleep, and I'll talk to you when I wake up.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't followed by the
officer.
That
wasn't how you get a confession.
That's exactly right. You have to keep at it. I suspect many of us would be vulnerable without sleep. after, and frightened. You know, young people, children are more vulnerable than adults. And,
well, Robert was 18 at the time?
You know, he was 18 chronologically, and when we first started working with him, just in an amateur way, we thought he was about 14 years old emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
He just wasn't very mature in contrast to the way he is today.
I understand. Robert, I'm going to slide this mic over to you.
All right.
Tell me a little bit about, well, how old were you? Were you 18 when these things happened?
Yes, ma'am.
And how old are you now?
31.
When did you get out?
December 21st.
This past December?
Yes.
So you were locked up for almost 13
almost
years?
Almost 13 years, yes, ma'am.
Can you tell me, do you remember the police interrogation? Do you remember being arrested and what happened?
I remember being surrounded by gunpoint. Me and my friend, we were waiting for, it was supposed to be my mom because something had happened at home, and she said, can you meet me at the Walmart?
Okay.
Well, that was something that the detective had kind of forced her to do. I'm thinking something's wrong with my mom.
In other words, the detective had your mother call you on the phone,
yes,
and tell you there was an emergency of some sort and you should come and meet her in the Walmart parking lot.
Yeah.
And you went there thinking something must have happened to her.
Yes, ma'am.
And then you were arrested. Tell me how that went down.
They surrounded our vehicle, pulled me out and threw me down to the ground forcefully, and I'd have to say at least 20 officers with guns drawn on me. They put their knee in my back, handcuffed me forcefully, even though I wasn't fighting them, and then drove me from Stanton to Charlottesville.
Now, when they did that, did you know you had been implicated?
No.
Did you even know this murder had happened?
Yes.
You'd heard about it on the news?
No, I live on the same street that it happened. My friend told me there was a fire down the street, and mm-hmm. me being the person that I am, I was going to see if I could help
anyway.
So I got my next-door neighbor, and we both went down there.
Uh-huh.
And at one point in time, the fire one of the firefighters said, hey, can y'all two go grab some oxygen tanks?
Uh-huh.
And that's what we did.
Grabbed some oxygen tanks,
yeah.
What, out of the fire equipment?
Yeah. From another truck down the street.
So this was after the murder, when the fire was actually happening. You lived nearby, and
yes,
so you
ma'am.
Went over there.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So you knew it had happened, but you didn't have any idea that you were a suspect at the time
ma'am.
That you're drawn down on by all these cops and cuffed.
No, ma'am.
So where'd they take you?
They took me to the Albemarle County Police Department back in the old county building.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they got a new station now.
Mm-hmm. What was the room like that they put you in?
It was small. It was cold. It was two chairs and a metal desk.
Did it have any adornments, anything on the walls? Did it have any windows?
No, ma'am.
Just literally two chairs and a metal desk.
Yeah.
What kind of chairs?
Kind of like, I guess they were like metal chairs. Like
folding chairs or something?
No, not folding chairs. Like stuff you'd see in a doctor's office or something.
Okay.
Them hard.
Nothing, we're not talking about anything plush.
No.
So you're in this room. How big do you think this room is?
Probably 12 by 16.
Yeah?
12 by 12.
Okay. And who's in the room with you?
Randy Sneed and something Wells.
Couple cops?
They were detectives.
So you and two detectives?
Yes, ma'am.
And they
would switch off back and forth, you know.
In terms of who was questioning you?
Yeah.
Where were they positioned in relation to you and in relation to the door?
They were between me and the door.
Okay.
And they were sitting about as close as you and I are.
I would say that our knees are about 3 feet apart here in the studio. Was there anything between you and them?
No.
Was the desk kind of off to the side?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Where I was sat, I'm in the actual corner of the room in between the wall and the desk, so
mm-hmm.
I really didn't have nowhere to go.
Okay. Were you being videotaped during this experience?
Yes, but I didn't know that I was.
You were, no, you were being recorded.
No.
Okay. And tell me about how long were you in that room with them that day?
Probably about 6 hours.
Okay.
6 to 7 hours.
How did it begin?
They read me the Miranda rights, and I didn't, never been really in trouble that much, and so I didn't know what they were. I didn't know that I, what they all were saying. I just signed a paper.
Okay.
And, you know, but,
did you not understand when they said you don't have to make any statements?
No.
You just, why? Why did you talk to him at all?
Well, because I had known Randy Snead since I was a kid.
Oh, how'd you know Randy?
My mom and him and his father used to hang out together and everything.
Oh, okay.
And so I knew him, and I had, I guess, an acquaintance with him.
Mm-hmm.
He was also the school resource officer at the school that I went to.
I see. So you probably saw him every day at school.
Yeah.
Just around.
Yeah.
So you signed the Miranda waiver document and didn't really understand what you were waiving at the time. And then they started questioning you. And they questioned you for 6 hours?
Yeah. Roughly 6 hours.
Can you tell me anything about what that was like, what kind of questions they asked you, and how you felt during it?
I felt scared the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, during this time, I was just trying to go home and be with my family and everything. And Detective Snead, he knew what buttons to push, you know. And on a couple bathroom breaks, they told me, if you don't, I guess because it wasn't being recorded, he said, if you don't tell us what we want to hear, your mom will get locked up and your little brother will be put in foster care.
They said that to you?
Yeah.
But not in front of the cameras?
But not in front of the cameras.
Because they knew it was being recorded.
Yeah.
And you didn't.
And he lied to me as well, saying that he had DNA evidence against me, which I knew that they didn't have because I had never stepped foot in the house. And just said that I had so much, they had so much stuff on me that they knew that I was there and all that.
So, just for everybody who might be tuning in now, this is 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, Straight Talk, and my guests today are Steve Rosenfield and Robert Davis. Robert Davis is telling us about his interrogation, in which, after which he ended up in prison for almost 13 years for the murder he didn't commit. So, did you know when you're sitting there and the police officers told you they had DNA evidence and things like that, did you know that they could lie to you?
No, I didn't know that they could lie to you.
In fact, they told you they couldn't lie to you, didn't they?
Right.
They told you, we're not allowed to lie to you.
Yep.
But they lied to you.
Yeah.
And tell me some of the things they told you that weren't true.
They said they had the DNA evidence against me. They said that they had found objects that belonged to me and stuff like that. And like I said, they lied to me and said that, you know, if I didn't tell them what they wanted to hear, my mom could get locked up and my little brother would go in foster care.
Now, how many of those things did they say to you on the tape as opposed to not on the tape?
I know they said they had the DNA evidence, and I know that, I'm pretty sure they said that they had stuff that belonged to me.
Mm-hmm. On tape.
Yeah.
And the stuff about the threats against your mom and your little brother,
they did off the tape.
Happened off outside.
Yes, ma'am.
Did they ever admit that they had made those threats outside, or did they insist that they had never said those things?
I'm sure they insisted that they never said those things.
I see. And of course, there's no way to prove it because you're in the police department and they know what's recorded and what isn't.
Yep.
So what did you think to yourself, knowing, you know, believing that the police couldn't lie to you? What did you think when they said, we've got your DNA at the scene?
I knew there was no way possible because I'd never been in there.
Right.
I knew I've never been inside that house. The only time I ever stepped foot in that yard was when the firefighters asked for oxygen tanks.
Right. So might they have had your DNA from being there when the firefighters had the oxygen tanks? Did you think that to yourself?
No, I didn't think
so. No, you just thought that can't be.
Right.
Did you tell them that wasn't possible?
I told them that I wasn't there and I didn't have anything to do with it.
What did they say when you would tell them that?
They just kept questioning me. You know, memory of that night of the interrogation is hazy. I tried to watch the interrogation itself, and I made it 5 minutes in, and it was just too upsetting.
I can understand that. I have about a 4 minute clip of it that I would like to play today, but I won't play it unless I have your permission.
No, go ahead and play it. I'll just.
Are you sure?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't want to bring back something so awful for you.
I'm learning to deal with it. Every day is a new day, and it's filled with hope and joy that now that I'm home. So
the piece I want to play is about 5 hours in to this 6-hour interrogation, in which you know, they're continuing to tell you that you have committed this crime, that they know you have committed this crime, and they're, you know, absolutely 100% certain, and you know, you just need to fess up to it. And you say to them at one point, "What do I need to say I did to get out of here or to get to go home?"
Right.
And that's sort of, in some ways, a turning point at which, you know, they get their confession, and I say that with air quotes.
Right.
But, you know, they sort of break you down. Is what it sounds like happens. Anyway, I think it would be instructive for people to hear the technique involved. So, Olivia August, Madam Producer, can I get you to play that clip for me?
That's the deal. I can't hide no. I sit there and talk to your mom. Your mom's upset and crying. And I'm trying to tell your mom that, damn it, I'm trying, Sandra. I'm trying. He won't talk to me. He won't open up and talk to me because he thinks I'm and I'm not. I'm telling you the damn truth. I know what took place. I know what happened. I know you was there. You won't talk to me. I can't keep this. I'm not going to be able to keep you from the worst, Robert. If you don't talk to me, I can't keep you from the worst.
What is it there?
Yeah, I'm dead, Robert. You were. You were there. The evidence shows you were there. The evidence shows you. I can't lie about the evidence. I can't.
What can I say?
You can't say nothing other than
what can I say?
Place.
What can I say that I did to get me out of this?
The only way you can get out of this is by talking the truth and saying you're part of it. And the thing is, you're not going to get out of it, Robert. I'm not going to lie to you. You're not going to get out of it. But you might save your life.
How many years would it be if I was just on the porch?
How many years will it be if you're just on the porch?
Robert, when will I go home?
Huh?
When will I go home today? Will I go home now?
I can't promise you. Look, let me tell you this way. Like I told your mom, you work with me, and I'm going to do everything I can to make sure your mom, and we can maybe get you home. But until I know the truth, and I get the truth, and let me tell you something. I know the truth, but until you tell me the truth, all right? I know where you were in the whole house, Robert, already. I already know, but I can't sit here and tell it for you, okay? And don't worry about the years. If you cooperate with me, then I can work with the Commonwealth and say that you cooperate with me. But son, if you don't cooperate with me, then I can't do that. And then I can't tell your mom that I can save you from the ultimate. I can't do it. I can't. My beliefs of telling your mom the truth and trying to help your mom, I can't do that. I can't tell her honestly. I can save Robert because Robert won't work with me. And it's killing me on that phone back there. Your mom is upset. She loves you, Robert, no matter what. She's loving you. And I'm doing the best to try to keep that family tie alive. No matter what you've done, she says, I still love him. He's my son. No matter what he's done. And I said, Sandra, I know. And I'm trying to get him to work with me. If he works with me, I will do everything I can to help you see him and get through this. But if I can't do that, I can't do that without him telling me the truth. And the thing is, I already know the truth, but I can't speak for him. Robert, I can't, son. I mean, we're going on 7 o'clock. I told her I can't go much longer. I can't go much longer, son. You've got to start talking to me. I can't, man. And I'm going to be with you, Robert. You talk to me. I'm going to be with you, son. I'm not going to let you go by yourself. I'm going to walk through the whole thing with you. I'm there for your mom.
I just want to know, am I the killer? Is that what people say? Am I the killer?
I don't want to say that you are. Okay.
Please tell me
No, you're not the only one. No, you're not the only one. You're not the only one. I know that. You're not the only one.
Because I didn't kill nobody.
I know you're not the only one.
I didn't kill nobody.
Listen to me. Listen to me.
I didn't kill nobody.
Listen to me. Listen to me. I know you weren't the only one up there. Okay?
I didn't go upstairs.
Listen. I know.
I never went upstairs. I stood right there at the door, and then once I heard something, I got scared and I freaked out. I ran.
So, back on the air, guys. That whole interrogation, because it was your statement, your attorneys were able to get a copy of it. Most of the evidence in criminal cases, defense counsel can't get a copy of. But because it was your alleged confession, your lawyers were able to get a copy of that.
Yes, ma'am.
Whole interview. And the whole thing is actually up on YouTube at Robert Davis Police Interrogation. If you search that in YouTube, you can find the entire interrogation interview on there. So, you know, what it sounds like to me, the officer says, you know, he's telling you you've done this. And at some point he talks about the ultimate. And he says, you know, how can I tell your mother? How can I go out in the hallway and tell your mother that you won't talk to me? And if you don't talk to me, I can't save you from the ultimate. How'd you interpret that? What was the ultimate?
I've watched movies. To me, the ultimate meant the death penalty.
So you understood that he was saying, if you don't confess to me, you're going to be killed.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes, ma'am.
We're going to seek the death penalty, and you're going to die.
Yeah.
And then the bit about your mom out in the hallway, he kind of makes it seem like, you know, your mama wants you to confess.
Yeah.
Did your mama want you to confess?
No.
To a crime you didn't commit?
No.
How did you interpret that at the time? I mean, what did you think when he said that?
You know what? I don't know. It's been so long, and I've blocked a lot of that night out. So.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet you did. At some point, you said something like, you know, how much time will I get if I was just on the porch?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Why'd you say that?
Because basically they wanted me to say, I guess this was after the time that I said, what do you want me to say?
Mm-hmm.
And I just figured that would be like the least important thing.
So you were trying to say something so that they would stop what
yeah.
they were doing.
Yeah.
And so you were just looking for something that would satisfy them without any regard for whether it was true or not.
Yes, ma'am. Because they damn sure won't listen to me tell the truth.
No, I guess not. So what happened when you did finally say, okay, I was there, I did it. How did the behavior of the police toward you change?
It didn't change. It was still the same.
It was the same.
At one point in time, they said, well, we got you hitting her with something. And I said, okay, Louisville Slugger, which is a baseball bat.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew that that was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, they won't. They won't that. So I, okay, so hits with something, so a clubbing device. You know, because.
Did you say a clubbing device?
Yeah.
Where did you get the words a clubbing device?
I don't know.
Okay, but you picked a baseball bat because it seemed like something you might hit somebody with, and you said, that's what I hit her with.
Yeah.
And they knew that wasn't it, so they told you, no, that wasn't quite it, and sort of tried, you know, so then you made another guess?
Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe I hit her with a clubbing device.
Yeah.
Wow. Go ahead, Steve. I can tell you want to say something.
Yeah, Andre, you know, the only funny part that demonstrates the incompetence of this detective is that after they went through this dance about Robert, we know you struck her, and Robert doesn't have a clue what it's about, and they feed him, which is a no-no in mm-hmm. police interrogation. About three pages later in the transcript of the interrogation, maybe it's about a minute or so on watching it, they say, Robert, you didn't hit her, somebody else hit her. And so after trying to cajole him into saying that he hit Nola Charles, they later, moments later, admitted that he didn't do it. It's just baffling.
Did they get him to admit that he did do it before they then got him to, before they then told him he didn't do it?
After he said that it must have been a clubbing device that he used, they moved on and then came back and said, Robert, we know somebody else did that. And, you know, I can only guess what was going through Robert's mind. It's not revealed on the camera, but, you know, you're told that you did something, you admit to doing something, and then moments later they say, no, you didn't do it. And it was just one of a number of examples of the incompetence of the detectives who conducted this interrogation.
So we're listening to 94.7 WPBC. We're going to take a break just for a second for a few announcements, and we'll be right back with Robert Davis and Steve Rosenfield.
For this Valentine's Day edition of The Wake Up Call, Sean McCord will be in for Rick Moore. The guest will be WPBC personality Leslie Scott Jones. Before becoming the host of 94.7's Homegrown, Leslie hosted her own internet radio romantic advice show as the Goddess Elle. We'll revive that character, talk about her experience, and of course, take your calls. That's the Valentine's Day Wake Up Call, Sunday, tomorrow morning at 11, brought to you by Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. It's currently partly cloudy today with a high of 23. Clear skies tonight with a low of 10. Partly cloudy tomorrow, high 30. Right now, partly cloudy and 21 degrees at RH92-3.
Are you approaching retirement or getting ready to claim your Social Security benefits? If so, then you should know how the new 2016 rules apply to you. And if you're eligible for the extended deadline of May 1st, 2016 to claim benefits using the old rules, knowing how Social Security works means you keep thousands of your hard-earned retirement dollars in your pocket. You can come to the Public Service No Obligation Social Security Workshop on Monday, February 29th or Wednesday, March 2nd at the Jefferson Madison Public Library in Charlottesville at 6 o'clock and learn how you can take advantage of your Social Security benefits.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
So, this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes, and in the studio today we have Steve Rosenfield, who's an attorney, and Robert Davis. Robert Davis has been represented by Mr. Rosenfield for some time. Mr. Davis was convicted of a murder that he did not commit, spent about 13 years in prison for it, and was just recently conditionally pardoned. And that conviction was based largely on a false confession extracted by police. So we were talking about the interview, the interrogation, really, that went on for about 6 hours. You eventually said whatever they wanted you to say, which was that you had taken part in this. Then there was a trial. And how much time passed in between the, you know, you're making those statements and you're actually going to trial? Do you have any idea?
Almost 2 years. I think it was like a year and not...
Year and a half, maybe?
Yeah, year and a half.
And in that time period, what did you think was going to happen at trial? Did you think, you know, this is all going to be okay because I didn't do it, you know? I honestly thought
that the truth would prevail, that the coerced confession would be thrown out and all that. But when it wasn't, then I realized that things were going to get tough.
So was there a motions hearing at some point in between the confession and the trial date where your attorneys sought to kick out that confession?
Yes, ma'am.
And do you remember anything about that hearing?
Not really. No.
But you remember that you didn't win.
Right.
And the confession was going to come into evidence.
Yeah.
I think that Steve had mentioned that it was him and Denise Lunsford that represented you.
Yes, ma'am.
Was Denise working on it at that time as well?
Yes, ma'am.
So Do you know when in that two-year period that hearing happened about the whether or not it was going to come in? Was it in the middle of that period? Was it toward the trial end? Was it...
The
hearing where they decided that the confession was going to come into evidence over your attorney's objections.
I think it was towards the beginning, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the preliminary hearing.
All right. And then when you went to trial itself, do you remember anything about the trial?
Not really.
How come you don't remember?
Because I was on so many different antidepressants and stuff that they had put me on and all this other stuff,
mm-hmm.
that my mind was, I was a walking zombie.
Now, when I say trial, I don't mean that they put on witnesses and evidence and there was a jury and there was a, you know, week long.
Right.
I really just mean it was really a plea. Yes. I mean, you went up and you basically pled guilty, although you pled under something called an Alford plea.
Yes, ma'am.
What's an Alford plea? Can you explain that in your own words?
An Alford plea is where I plead guilty, but I maintain my innocence, but know that they have enough evidence to convict me.
And how did you come to decide you should enter an Alford plea?
Through a couple months of talking about it when it was first offered. You know, Steve and Denise both said that, you know, this would be an opportunity for you to possibly go home still as a young man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, 40's pretty young still, so...
Was the death penalty on the table?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so they weren't prosecuted, wasn't, you know, do this or we're going
to
seek the death penalty. It was a do this or we're going to seek essentially multiple life terms.
Yes, ma'am.
And given the, essentially both of the kids who had actually done the killing at that point had implicated you.
Yes, ma'am, and had we gone to trial, they would have... testified and lied against me,
mm-hmm.
at the court hearings.
Right. And so they would have said you'd done it.
Yes, ma'am.
And so you decided to take a plea basically to alleviate the risk that you would spend essentially the rest of your life in prison.
Yes, ma'am.
But you maintained it under Alford because you also, you know, didn't really do it.
Yes, ma'am.
Here's a question for you, and I want you to think about this. If the Commonwealth attorney had insisted that you either plead guilty, not Alford, but admit guilt, or go to trial, would you have entered a guilty plea?
That's a tough question to answer. I don't have an answer for that because I think I would have. I think Steve and Denise would have both fought tooth and nail the entire way.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I hadn't taken the Alford plea, I think that they would have fought tooth and nail.
I think they would have fought tooth and nail, too. I know both Steve and Denise, and I know they are tooth and nail fighters. But that doesn't necessarily mean they would have won, which I guess is why we ended up here.
Yes, ma'am.
So you went to prison.
Yes, ma'am.
Where were you in prison?
All over the place. I started my time out at Powhatan Receiving, and I stayed there for 9 months. Normally, when you go through a receiving, it only takes a couple weeks,
mm-hmm.
and you're to your destination.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I went to Nottoway, which was a maximum security prison.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Greensville down in Emporia. And then I went to Haynesville, which was I don't know where Haynesville's at. But I only stayed there for 7 weeks. Then I went to Powhatan, general population, for 3 years, and then I was at Coffeywood for about 4.5.
So you stayed in Virginia?
Yes, ma'am.
And during that long period of time, did you ever regret your decision to take an Alford plea?
Yeah, I did. Because there I sat in a cell knowing that I was innocent. And I was doing time.
What was it like? What was prison like?
You know, it's not what they make it seem like on TV, but you know, it's a horrible place, horrible conditions and all that.
Tell me what you mean.
Horrible living conditions, uh, hor- horrible health care.
Give some substance to horrible living conditions. Tell me something
dirty.
Concrete.
Dirty. You get your clothes washed once a week. And so you've got two people living in a cell with dirty clothes, and it stinks all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Just not proper cleaning supplies. They might give you a broom and something that passes for Pine Sol, which is super diluted, mm-hmm. so it doesn't clean anything. And then when you're at a lower level, like a dormitory, like Coffeewood was, you're in a building with 83 people with no privacy at all.
When you say no privacy, what do you mean?
You can't, if you want to get away from something, you can't go step into a cell and shut the door. You're right there beside a person. When you go to use the bathroom, we're closer than where we are now, beside each other with no doors. When the food was just horrible.
What do you mean? Tell me about what the food was like.
The food is a lot of processed stuff, and mm-hmm. it's a lot of the time has expired, and it also has, on some of the packagings I've seen, for institutional use only. So it's stuff that you wouldn't even feed the public.
I see. And how did your knowing you were innocent all this time affect you emotionally there? Would it have been a different experience if you knew you had actually done something? Do you think it would have felt different?
I don't know. I couldn't answer that honestly because I never really thought about it.
I got it. Well, it sounds horrific. When was the first time that something happened that made you think you might have a hope of getting out of there, that this might turn around?
When Steve came to Greensville and told me that Rocky had told the truth, saying that I wasn't there and didn't have any acknowledgement of the crime and had nothing to do with it.
Now, Rocky was a kid who was in school with you?
Yes, ma'am.
And it was he and his sister who had carried out this murder?
Yes, ma'am.
How did they come to name you in this?
Rocky said he wanted to push the blame all the way off, some of the way off of him, and just mm-hmm. started naming people. And I think his sister, while Randy Sneed was interrogating her, at one point had said, "Well, what about Robert? I mean, Rocky." And then later in her interrogation, she implicated me.
I see. Which sort of probably made them think it had some credibility to it, since she misspoke and the name that she said was Robert.
No, that was Randy who said
that. Oh, that was Randy.
That. Yeah, that was the detective, Randy Sneed.
Oh, wait, I'm confused. You're saying that Detective Sneed, in questioning the girl, said, "What about Robert? I mean, Rocky." Which yes, then ma'am. Put the name in your sister's mind, not your sister, in Rocky's sister's mind,
yes,
so
ma'am.
That then Rocky's sister could later come back and say, "Robert."
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wow. And was that after Sneed had talked to Rocky and Rocky had said that...
Yes, ma'am.
...you were involved?
I was the last one to be interrogated.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, do you know what prompted Rocky to decide to... Well, do you know why he picked you?
Because we didn't get along. You know, him and I had problems all through middle school and high school where he would bully me. I was always taught to walk away from fights and all that, and he'd still bully me and all that. At one incident, he ended up beating me up on the school bus mm-hmm. route waiting to get on the bus.
Mm-hmm, a bus stop?
Yeah.
It's okay.
We ended up going to court over it.
So he picked you because he didn't like you. And the police didn't think this was sort of odd that he had chosen to commit this murder arson with somebody who he didn't get along with?
Yeah, I don't know.
Famously?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the police thought.
Okay.
Obviously, you know, they weren't thinking. I think that they just wanted to get a conviction. No, by any means necessary.
When When Steve came to see you and he told you that Rocky had come forward and said, look, you know, this really, you know, Robert really didn't have anything to do with it. How did you feel at that moment?
I felt that the truth was finally coming out. I felt like there was a possible chance of coming home.
Mm-hmm.
Because Steve had talked to me about a petition and everything to the governor for clemency and all that. So at that point in time, I started feeling hope. You know.
And do you know what year that was? Or how long into your...
I think it was 2005, somewhere around there.
So that was...
I remember it was warm outside.
You've been in there for a little while at that point in time.
Yeah.
Because the homicides happened in, what, 2003?
Yeah.
So you'd been in there, but not too long. It didn't take too long.
If I'm not mistaken, I think it was 2006.
Yeah.
Because I had already been to Nottoway, and I had been at Greensville for some time.
Mm-hmm. So then you've been there 2 to 2.5, 3 years, and you get this ray of hope. But it's still another 10 years before you get out.
Yeah.
What was that like?
It played on my mind for a while. I was medicated for a long time, but I didn't like walking around like a zombie, so I stopped taking...
When you say you were medicated, what do you mean?
They had me on so many different antidepressants. I was still depressed and everything, you know. But after I stopped taking them, I felt clearer head and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, felt better, you know. And it was just another 10 years wait, you know, and I understood that it took time for the petition to get wrote and all that. And then Jessica had finally spoke up.
Jessica's Rocky's sister?
Yes, ma'am.
And when did that happen?
I'm going to say roughly about 2011, 2012.
So 5 years or more after her brother says, yeah, this didn't happen, then she says it didn't happen.
Yes, ma'am.
Wow, did she give any further explanation of how it came to be that she named you?
I'm not real for sure of the whole story. Steve was in contact with her. I wasn't.
All right, Steve, do you know what she said about why she did that?
What was interesting is that I had to wait for a period of time because her appeals took years and years, a very unusual lengthy appeal process for her. She was found incompetent to stand trial, so that delayed it more. And ultimately, when time was up and she no longer had a lawyer, I contacted her by mail, asked if I could come talk to her. She said, sure. I took a witness with me. She said Robert was involved, but she couldn't give me any details to questions I asked about, was he upstairs? Mm-hmm. Did he open up the refrigerator? What did he do? That was discouraging. And over the next 6 months, I would write to her with these morality questions about, you can't possibly feel good about Robert being in prison for something he didn't do. Won't you tell the truth? Finally, the warden told me that I could no longer communicate with Jessica. So I was barred from that. 2 years later, Jessica wrote to me and said, I've made a terrible decision to lie about your client. Won't you come speak to me? I took a witness with me again, and this time she was very candid. It was the first time that she had ever told anybody about what she had done. She didn't even tell her lawyer about how she stabbed Nola, how she took from her house a lead pipe to be used to strike Nola. So it was premeditated.
Not a Louisville slugger.
Not a Louisville slugger.
But in fact, a clubbing device of a different nature.
Not your traditional clubbing device. So ultimately, she came around, it was very rewarding. That was submitted to the McDonald people as well.
Did she say why she did this? Why did she say that Robert had done this? Did the police tell her that her brother had said this?
You know, Andre, she had implicated four boys before she even got to Robert. And as Robert correctly explained, it was suggested
by
perhaps inadvertently, but nevertheless, Robert's name had never come up by Jessica, which was certainly a telltale sign to us lawyers about the credibility of Jessica implicating Robert.
I see. And then when you did file the petition for clemency, first you filed it with McDonald, right?
That's correct.
The McDonald administration, and McDonald didn't even look at it.
You know, I was actually shocked. I suspect that...
I'm not shocked.
Well, no.
Are you really shocked, Steve?
Good point. I feel naive in saying that. But the truth of the matter is that his people, somebody probably saw a guy confessed, and one of the killers says Robert was involved. What's there to investigate?
Right.
The volume, I had submitted 6 volumes of records that were probably about, I'd say, a foot thick. And if you don't have a sense of an interest in justice and you have a lot of work to do, it's a recipe for doing nothing. And that's exactly what McDonald. But as I had said
Meaning
earlier...
through, when you say 6 volumes of records that were a foot thick, you mean all 6 volumes together were a foot, or you mean each volume was a foot?
Cumulatively, they were a foot.
A foot of evidence.
A foot of evidence, including transcripts, affidavits. We must have had 15 affidavits from many different sources, our experts. We had experts talk about the inadequacy and flawed interrogation. One of them, a PhD in police interrogation, Andrew Griffiths, started out as a bobby in England, a police officer, worked his way up to become the highest-ranking detective in Great Britain, has written extensively on police interrogation, travels the world teaching, including teaching law enforcement in the United States. He gave us a 10-page affidavit pointing out all the flaws, and this was submitted to the governors. Jim Trainum, a homicide detective in Washington, D.C., 17 years, and he saw this, and he submitted about an 8-page affidavit talking about the flaws, all for free. Everybody involved in this case did this out of a sense of an injustice had been committed and it needed to be righted.
Let me guess, you and Denise were court-appointed.
That's correct.
Well, what'd you get paid for this case, Steve?
Well, in lower court, Virginia, as you well know, has the lowest paid court-appointed system in the nation.
Yeah, I mean, what was the sum total of the compensation that you received for this 13-year-long representation in which you finally achieved the freedom of your innocent client?
It's about a few $100, maybe $300, $400.
Including circuit court?
Including circuit court.
Wow.
$6.
Well, how many hours do you think you put into this, Steve?
Well, I probably put in 1,500 to 2,000 hours now, counting this
radio
show.
Did you figure out your hourly rate?
Yeah, I told Robert I wanted to get him out of prison so he could pay me back the $600,000.
There you go.
I had earned.
There you go.
But, you know, that's what we lawyers should do and do.
I heard a lot of names of experts from Maryland and different places, and there was some, you know, there was a UVA professor involved, but how did the Albemarle County Police Department react to the petition for clemency? Were they open to it at all? Were they helpful in any way?
The Dateline NBC producer tried to get an interview with the chief of police with Albemarle County for 2 years, and he refused to talk with her about the interrogation. And once the pardon, I should back up. When I met with the governor, he asked me if the police had cooperated, and I told him the story about Dateline.
Mm-hmm.
And in the room was the Deputy Secretary of Public Safety for Virginia. And he looked at her and said, what did you learn? Because the governor's office did the investigation that ultimately got Robert the pardon. And she said, Governor, the police department has refused to cooperate except to say that Robert should have done, should do all of his prison sentence.
Wow.
What's the epilogue to this is that Dateline got Chief Sellers on tape now saying that he looked at the police interrogation and he thinks it's unreliable. And I just want to add this. The irony is this. You have two killers coming forward and owning up to the truth, saying that Robert wasn't involved. That's their moral position. Then you have a police department who for 12 years has remained silent about whether their work was credible enough to validate a claim that this was a credible and reliable confession. They remained silent. They refused to say anything. Once Robert was pardoned, they now came out and said that Robert, that the confession was unreliable. You judge the morality between the two killers and the police department who knowingly allowed an innocent man to be in prison. And that's the takeaway that I have on it, and it's disappointing at a time when police departments all over the country are trying to establish credibility with communities and knowingly allow an innocent man to remain in prison.
Well, it's certainly sobering. You mentioned NBC Dateline doing an interview, and I just wanted to say that interview is going to be on NBC tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
That's right. It's the fourth part of a four-part series on wrongful confessions. Robert is will be the focus of it. Dateline must have spent among the many people they interviewed, they must have put in about 60 hours of taping. So it's really an important program for people to see and to understand, just as you've helped educate the public about how this process works.
Well, I don't think I'm quite NBC Dateline, but this was a really great interview. I really appreciate you guys coming and doing this. I do want to mention another thing that is happening. Robert's brother, your brother's a musician, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And what's his name?
Lester Seal.
And is Lester doing a benefit for you coming up? Tell me about that. When's that happening?
He's doing a benefit February 20th, and it starts at 3 at the Ix Art Park.
Okay.
It's going to be live music. I think there's like 7 or 8 bands.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be speakers from the university, and I think it was Dr. Jeffrey Aaron who will be speaking as well, somebody from the Innocence Project.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, ma'am.
It's not Deirdre Enright, is it?
Yes, ma'am.
We had Deirdre on this show maybe, I don't know, a month ago or so. She's a great speaker. She's a really fascinating lady. Wow. And you don't need advance tickets to go do that.
No,
you just
no,
go. Just what's the entry price?
$10. And okay. Then they'll have drinks and food and stuff there as well.
And that's going to buy Steve a new briefcase, right?
Yes.
For the next $400, 13-year representation that he does. Thank you for being willing, after having undergone this horror, to talk about it and to educate people about it. It is important for people to understand that this is real, that these things happen.
It is, and I'm glad that you let me come in and get my story out, and hopefully somebody maybe learned something.
I'm grateful to you. And it looks to me like you're doing okay now. Yes, how's life treating you on the outside, Robert?
A lot of positivity.
Yeah?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Well, I think we're going to leave it there for this week. This is 94.7 WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, and you have been listening to Straight Talk, which is a program dealing with law and social justice issues, produced right here in Charlottesville with myself, Andre Hakes, and our very own Olivia August, who is my producer. And I am signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend, everybody.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville.